This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest John Burns is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He's serving as the bureau chief for the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He started writing about the region long before September 11th. In 1997, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Taliban's takeover. It was his second Pulitzer. His first was for the coverage of Bosnia in 1993. Burns has been with The Times since 1975 and has served as bureau chief in New Delhi, Toronto, Beijing, and Moscow. He's on a brief visit to the United States before returning to Afghanistan. He says that the U.S. military is searching for bin Laden in southeast Afghanistan, where the terrain makes it difficult to hunt for anyone. The area is mountainous with a sparse population. Caves are everywhere. There are no roads, only donkey trails. I asked him to describe the U.S. military operation there.
My impression is that American armed forces are learning on the job, understandably. First of all, it's an area of the world in which, thankfully, they have not been involved in combat before. Secondly, thankfully, American forces have only really been involved in combat anywhere since the Vietnam War. And you now have a situation where American military commanders, several of them that I've encountered, are post-Vietnam officers. So if they're learning on the job, it's not surprising. Quite a few mistakes were made. To start with your question, the most recent tactic is to put American boots on the ground, along with principally British, but also Australian, Canadian, Danish, and others, to go in search of bin Laden in small force units, helicopter-borne. This is a difference from earlier in the ground combat phase of the war, where the emphasis was mainly on using allied Afghan forces, allied to high-altitude bombing. That's what we saw at Tora Bora, which was, as you recall, in November, December, the first place that sightings of bin Laden were reported. Subsequently, at the battle at Shaikot, southwest of Kabul, in March. And the consequences of relying on Afghan ground forces in large numbers at Tora Bora were that, in my view, if bin Laden was there, and he probably was, it enabled him to escape. It also resulted, unhappily, because of reliance on Afghan intelligence, on a much higher level of Afghan civilian casualties than I think was tolerable. Now, that's changed lately. There's much less bombing. There are many more American and allied boots on the ground. And I think this is now a much, much more effective military strategy.
Can you be more specific about the higher level of casualties than is tolerable?
Yes. It's very difficult, and I think probably would be foolish of me to try and estimate how many people have died. At the lower estimate, it's hundreds. At the higher estimates, it would be thousands. And, of course, people who have concentrated on this, including some American relief organizations in Afghanistan, which have made a particular focus of this issue, very often use as a kind of benchmark 2,823, I believe, was it, the number of people who died at the World Trade Center, as if a figure in excess of that, Afghan civilian casualties, would change the fundamental moral balance of the war. I personally can't agree with that at all. I think we really don't know. We do know that large numbers of Afghan villages have been bombed, and that quite large number of Afghan civilians who were, as far as we can tell, completely innocent of any involvement with al-Qaeda and the Taliban have died. Some of these bombing raids, if not most of them, resulted from reliance on Afghan intelligence that was faulty, late, or poisoned. There are not a wide range of choices in terms of Afghan military allies. And the United States has probably made some very hard choices in doing so. When I say that I can't personally accept any kind of moral equation between the numbers of Afghan civilians who have died, regrettable as that is, and the Americans who died on September the 11th, it's for the very obvious and simple reason that what happened on September the 11th was willful, intended, deliberate. And the deaths of Afghan civilians, of course, has not been deliberate. I think, having said that, it's also true that in time, and I'm sure this will be the case, the Congress of the United States and the administration might want to consider listening to the voices of those Afghans who have survived those bombing raids, who, wherever we go, in the combat areas appealed to us for American compensation, or at least consideration. I met a man last week in a village in eastern Afghanistan, near to a site of one of these bombing raids, who said to me, and he was standing in a house that had been destroyed by Russian bombing, Soviet bombing, during the period of Soviet military occupation in the 1980s, to which he had just returned as a refugee from Pakistan. So he was enormously grateful to the United States for the liberation that allowed him to go home after 22 years. But he has relatives who have been subjected to American bombing, and he said, what we would really like is an apology. I think they want some sort of recognition, and I know that in the largeness of spirit of which this country is capable, that, of course, is possible, and I'm sure in time will be done.
Yes. When you're dealing with the bombing, American bombing of villages in Afghanistan, bombings that were either a mistake or that, you know, accidentally killed civilians while looking for leaders of al-Qaeda, do you feel pressure from either side to report, or to not report, as the case may be, the number of casualties? Is there any pressure from Afghan sources to make sure you go with the story? Is there any pressure from military sources to play it down?
No, I don't think that pressure is exactly the right phrase, and not from Afghan sources. As a matter of fact, even in the Karzai government in Kabul, the American-backed government in Kabul, there's considerable unease about this question of American bombing with unintended civilian casualties. The foreign minister, Abdullah, told me a couple of weeks ago that he felt that if Ahmad Shah Massoud, who, as you know, was assassinated, the Northern Alliance leader who was assassinated by al-Qaeda on September the 9th, had been alive, and therefore likely would then now be the defense minister in the new government, that he would have insisted that more caution be taken by American commanders in the question of bombing of villages in particular. So no pressure from Afghans. The pressures are, in some respects, ones which are self-induced, and they are these. If you're going to say that American bombs have killed significant numbers of civilian casualties, you've got to be absolutely sure about it. And by definition, we reach these places very often at a considerable remove in time and distance. And it's sometimes very difficult to sort out, especially since American military commanders have not altogether been candid about these particular operations to determine what really happened. So I think the straightforward answer is that the New York Times, I'm pretty certain, is keen to know as much as it can about this war, I am certain, in every respect. But we, if we have perhaps given less attention to this, and I think we should, it's partly because we feel we need to know more. We're under tremendous pressure in any event in covering the news. These bombing sites, these villages are often very far distant from where we are. And we want to be sure about it. It is a subject that we're going to be paying more and more attention to. We have already. I personally have written stories about civilian casualties from American bombing, as have my colleagues. But if you sense a sense of some unease on my part, it would be correct. I think it's something that we need to do more about, but we need to be very sure that we're on sound ground when we do it.
I know that some of the fighting now is happening in a very geographically challenging area, so it's hard for you to get there. But do you have access to it? Is the military allowing you the access that you'd like to have to cover the war as it continues in this phase?
I would guess that no correspondent of my newspaper or any other American or Western newspaper ever assigned to a war would say yes to that. It's just in the nature of the relationship between armies in combat and what we do in the media business that we will never be satisfied. I think they could do more than they've done. The Shaykot battle, they did provide access to reporters and photographers to go up, but it was pretty unsatisfactory. On the other hand, you have to say that if you put a reporter or a photographer into the middle of combat, either you're going to have him fend for himself, in which case he's likely to end up dead, or you're going to have to commit people to protect him, and that's a pretty costly enterprise. And so there's always a kind of to and fro on this. We'd like more access. We're getting very little access to the current phase of the war, this small force
And is that because of the nature of the fighting, or is that because the military doesn't want you to see?
Well, I'm sure it's both. I'm sure it's both. And we've been far from satisfied, not just with access, but with the kind of flow of information that we've got. I think in some respects, there's a lesson been taken from Vietnam here by the officers who currently command these operations, who feel that American forces in Vietnam were perhaps too accessible. And so this has been an issue. It's absolutely an issue. But you have to say also that the resources are limited by nature of the American decision to limit the number of troops on the ground and the number of helicopters. They don't have a surfeit of choices in all of this. But clearly, if the question is, do we have enough access, the answer is we do not. We'd like more.
My guest is John Burns, a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He's reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Burns. He's a New York Times foreign correspondent. He's the bureau chief for the war in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he's been covering that region for about 14 years. What story have you taken the biggest risk to report?
I suppose in my own case, in the early phases of the Shaikot battle, when I was frustrated at being unable to get on American military helicopters that were flying out of the Bagram Air Base north of Kabul. It's an old Soviet air base about 40 miles north of Kabul. And there were so-called embedded press, that is to say, press who are mostly Washington-based, who had joined American forces long before that operation actually began. And some of them actually went up to the battlefield almost as soon as it began and stayed with the troops on an embargoed basis for 72 hours. We, who were Afghan-based reporters, didn't have that option. And it was pretty plain that they weren't going to give us that option. And so I decided to go to the battlefield myself and set off with an interpreter, a driver, and a photographer, and drove the 110 miles or thereabouts to the battlefield. And I should explain that what is perhaps cynically called the air show amongst the press corps in Afghanistan, which is to say that you can stand off from a battlefield and you can watch the vapor trails and the B-52s and the B-1s and the F-18s coming in. And it's an awesome, if terrible, sight to see the bombs falling on the mountaintops. And we stood back for about 2 days. And then the thought came to me, why stay 10 miles back if you can get a lot closer? And so the four of us in a Land Cruiser ventured over a plateau that lay between us and the mountain valley where the battle was being fought. And there is no marked no-go area. There's nothing anywhere which tells you don't proceed beyond this point because you're in active combat zone. It's a judgment you have to make for yourself. Fortunately, I had told my companions that since we were entering into an area where any movement spotted from American military helicopters would presumptively be an enemy movement, any ground movement, anybody driving in a Land Cruiser, I said, should the helicopters come after us, get out of the vehicle fast and deploy to left and right of the vehicle, stand toward the helicopters and put your hands in the air. Well, to my enormous consternation, when we'd got within about a mile of the active fighting, a group of American combat helicopters, which were tracing their way into the valley along the line of the mountains, suddenly two of them broke away from their course into the valley and started heading across the plateau directly for us and did that ominous thing that combat helicopters do when they're preparing to fire, which is they dip their noses. And we were looking straight at Apache or Cobra helicopters coming ever closer to us. We spread out from the Land Cruiser, put our arms in the air. Remember, we were right in the middle of an area where American combat troops had died and been wounded in significant numbers. We were driving a Land Cruiser, which is the standard mode of transport for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban when they don't travel by donkeys or horseback. We had no markings on the vehicle that would have been accessible to the pilots, which said press. And we stood there, and they came ever closer to us. And I have to say, I thought, well, this is probably it. And when they were within about 600 yards, probably, they pulled away sharply. And you can imagine we were very relieved. Later on, when I was back at Bagram, I mentioned to an American military officer that this had happened. And he said he'd heard about it from the pilot concerned. And they have apparently pretty advanced optics on those aircraft. And they had determined, looking at us with our hands in the air, that we were not Taliban and Al-Qaeda and therefore had not fired. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now.
When you said to yourself, this is it, back when you thought that you were going to be attacked by that Apache helicopter, did you say to yourself, this is it, but hey, it's really been worth it to be able to cover this war? Or did you feel like, you know, I wish I really hadn't been here?
No, I'll tell you what I thought. Many of my colleagues who have died as foreign correspondents have died despite all sensible precautions being taken. And in the end, most of us conclude that the essential variant is luck. What I thought standing on that plateau with those helicopters heading towards us over the 90 seconds or so before the crisis passed away was that if this turns out badly, people will hold me, and rightly so, responsible, that this was an irresponsible thing to do, to venture this far forward into a combat area. And we shouldn't be here. That was my principal sense. But to say that in, 2 months later, sitting in a studio in Berkeley, California, of course, somewhat overlooks the fact that you are making these decisions on a battlefield in a combat area under the pressure always of wanting to get closer to the story. That's a natural instinct. To find the right the balance in all of this is extremely, extremely hard. I learned a lesson from that. I don't think that I would do that that again. It ended up providing a quite useful page one story for the New York Times, but I'm quite sure that my editors, had any prior notice of this, would have said, this is absolutely more than we expect or want.
In your page one story, did you mention how you were almost killed, or did you leave that part out?
I left it out. I left it out. It's a difficult judgment to make as to whether, at what point, our personal situation becomes relevant to the reader. Thinking about it now, I think the part that probably was relevant not that we exposed ourselves to considerable hazard, but the fact that the American helicopter crews behaved in the way that they did. As carefully as they did, having written about instances in which villages and convoys have been bombed, where it turned out that the people who died were not Taliban or Al-Qaeda, it was quite instructive to me. And it wasn't the only instance at about that time that I saw that American armed forces do act with a degree of caution and accountability in these matters that I think in the history of warfare is unusual. And I give you another instance. At Bagram Air Base, immediately before and in the early phases of the Shaykot battle, I was quite surprised to find that they have lawyers attached to these combat units, in this case the 101st Airborne Division and the 10th Mountain Division, who went unit by unit before they were deployed into the valley, instructing them, or I would guess re-instructing the troops in the Geneva Conventions, and something called the law of ground warfare, land warfare, as I recall, which includes such things as proportionality, that you measure your response on the battlefield proportionally to the threat that to which you're subjected. That in order, before deeming somebody to be an enemy, and this, of course, is an area where it's extremely difficult to determine who is Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and who is not. But according to these briefings for these troops, it's necessary that somebody show hostile intent before he be attacked as a putative enemy. So I found that very instructive. And, you know, I'm pretty certain, because I was also in Afghanistan during the previous war, that is to say the war of Soviet occupation and the subsequent war in which the Soviet-dominated, Soviet-installed government hung on for 3 or 4 years after Soviet troops left. I doubt very much whether a Soviet or Afghan communist helicopter in that situation would have taken the trouble to determine whether these people standing in the mouth of a combat area in a land cruiser were enemy or not.
John Burns is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Burns. He's a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, based in Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's serving as the Times bureau chief for the coverage of the war. He's the Times' former Islamic affairs correspondent. Burns won a Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for his coverage of the Taliban takeover of Kabul. Where were you on September 11th, and how did you first hear about the terrorist attacks?
Well, I was actually in England. I was taking a day off, and I was about to go to the golf course. My job at that time was Islamic affairs correspondent, which had involved me over a period of some time in reporting on bin Laden and the traces of bin Laden, most prominently, I suppose, in the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, which is, you know, was the last major terrorist attack that preceded September the 11th. That occurred in October the 12th of the year 2000. And on that assignment, I had met a fellow by the name of Peter Bergen, probably well known to American television watchers, one of CNN's terrorism analysts after September the 11th, who was writing a book about bin Laden at the time we met in Yemen. As I prepared to go to the golf course just after lunch on September the 11th in England, Peter called me, and it was just after the first plane hit the first tower, and said nothing but, switch on the television, for God's sake. And I switched on the TV, and then I saw what the rest of the world saw with the second plane hitting the second tower. And I think there was no doubt, I'm pretty sure this was true for most Americans, but it was absolutely certain for any of us who had followed bin Laden over the years, that this was a bin Laden al-Qaeda operation. And I then put my hand up and volunteered to head eastwards to Pakistan and Afghanistan, which I did about 24 hours later, and I've been there ever since.
Having covered Afghanistan for many years, it must have been odd or even bizarre for you to see so many reporters coming in after September 11th.
Yes, it was, of course, and anybody who cared for Afghanistan had to feel that finally, after all of this turmoil and misery of the past 22, 23 years, America's misery on September the 11th was, in fact, the moment of likely liberation for Afghanistan. It's a huge paradox, but you talk to Afghans now who knew within, many of them almost within minutes of what had happened on September 11th, astonishingly fast. The news of what happened traveled to a country in which there's little electricity and very few television sets, but people heard about it over the Voice of America and the BBC and so forth. And there was a very wide recognition that what had happened in New York and Washington was likely portended the liberation of Afghanistan from Taliban and al-Qaeda. Afghans, at least, in their overwhelming majority, had very little doubt as to who was responsible for that.
My impression is now that many Muslims in the region of the world around Afghanistan are very angry at the United States, even though it was the United States that helped liberate Afghans from the rule of the Taliban. Have you come across many Muslims outside of Afghanistan who identify with the Afghans who wanted to be liberated from the Taliban and think of America as a hero of the story?
There are all kinds of cross currents in all of this. Many of them contradictory. Let me just focus on one issue, the question of bin Laden himself and their accountability, al-Qaeda's accountability for what happened. Afghans and Muslims in the wider world who there are, I won't say they're anywhere close to a majority, but there certainly is very large numbers of them, who identified in some way with bin Laden's political program, there's a kind of disconnect because it's extremely difficult to find anybody who will say to you that they endorsed what happened on September the 11th. That's the good news. That's universally condemned, even in the most militant madrasas in Pakistan, where many of the al-Qaeda and Taliban people had been indoctrinated right from September the 12th on, as in September the 11th, no doubt, too, but my experience from September 12th, 13th on, they dissented from that action, and they called it barbaric. But they immediately said that, of course, bin Laden cannot have been responsible for it. No Muslim could do this. They've maintained that position ever since, absurdly, of course, in face of the fact that there are videotapes in which bin Laden himself has, in fact, owned up to what happened. So the man is embraced, the act is disavowed, and the two, this obvious contradiction, is bridged by simply saying, well, he can't have done it. And that's a puzzling thing, but I think the conclusion for us is that, of course, bin Laden managed to appeal to millions of people in the in the Muslim world by distorting and offering a distorted account of what American policy in the Middle East is. But my feeling is that the ultimate answer to al-Qaeda and the Taliban does actually lie not in the field of military action, although they can be suppressed, of course, and largely eliminated for a considerable period by military action. In the end, it will lie in addressing the causes, and that's, of course, a very, very difficult, complex issue, but achieving a just peace in the Middle East would go a very long way towards that.
When do you return to Afghanistan?
I'm going to return from California to New York and then go on to back to Afghanistan, and I expect to spend the summer and the autumn, and from what I read in the New York Times of Monday's editions, some considerable time there. I think this war is going to go on for some time, and for my money, if you're a foreign correspondent right now, it's the most interesting place to be in the world.
Is there anything you're about to cover when you return to Afghanistan that you're particularly, like looking forward to covering or particularly interested in finding out more about?
Yes, there is. I think that it's understandable that American correspondents and the New York Times have concentrated very heavily on the battle with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The arc of that is descending somewhat. I don't think there are going to be any main force confrontations from now on. And what we need to do is we need to get more to the issue of the ascent of Afghanistan, to the social, economic problems, to the lives of the people of Afghanistan. We do it. We just don't do it enough. And I think that we'll be doing a lot more of that. In some ways, it's a more difficult thing to do. Covering military operations is an issue which sort of is concentrated. It means particular places at particular times, and there's a considerable degree of assistance that we get in that, driving to Bagram Air Base or getting on helicopters when they allow us to do it. We've got to get to the tough business of chronicling the lives of the people of Afghanistan much more fully than we have until now.
Well, John Burns, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
John Burns is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, based in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is Fresh Air.